Welcome to History Lessons, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast featuring the world's leading historians answering the big questions, hosted by Matthias Hesseris.
Welcome to History Lessons. Today I'm joined by Jessica Frazier. And Jessica is a fellow of the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies and a lecturer in theology and religion at Trinity College, Oxford. She's also a returning speaker to the yearly Engelsberg Seminar in Sweden, and you can read the results of a few of her lectures on Engelsberg Ideas. In this fourth episode of History Lessons, we are going to discuss what crises mean in an Asian perspective, drawing on four different traditions of thinking with quite different answers to how crisis should be approached and what lessons we can learn from living through a period of turmoil. We will discuss junsis, sea goddesses, dharma queens, and yogic deep dives. The previous episodes of this podcast were all recorded from home, with the guests calling in on shaky broadband connections. This one is recorded in a London studio, face-to-face with the appropriate COVID measures in place, of course. But it does feel like, with baby steps, it's getting back to a normal world, which I really cherish. And Jessica, is this dream I have of a return to the world as it was a typically Western vision?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that the Western culture is obsessed with crisis. Most of our stories are about a crisis and a hero who turns up and battles it. In a way, the demons and the monsters of our fairy tales are often expressions of that idea, of some sudden thing that appears out of the blue. And as we'll see, many cultures do think of things like pandemics as demons, right? And so I guess always the ideal that these cultures are looking at is someone who can get rid of the threat, put order back in place, and release us back into the norms of our everyday life, which we, you know, assume in these stories to be an ideal utopian world. So yeah, there's a kind of obsession with getting back to as things were.
Early on, I mean, we had this idea that we should sort of approach it as a war. And it goes back to the monster that we were supposed to battle and slay. Of course, a pandemic is quite different from a war. It's also harder to socialize and form units. On the contrary, we had to separate. When you're looking at the sort of Asian approaches, and of course, I mean, the virus originated in China and we have the first crisis there. To understand the Chinese approach, why is it important to go into Chinese philosophy when we look at how the COVID-19 crisis was framed in China? Are there any answers there?
I think it's really helpful to look at the way different cultures do it from the kind of template that we're all naturally falling into in the West. It's very easy to just do what we assume is the norm and not think about the alternatives. What you said is really insightful, that we think of it as war. We think of most threats as war, and we have this image in our head that warrior-like leaders, naturally endowed with strength, will lead us to fight hard until the thing is slain, and then we'll be okay. And indeed, in many ways, Western ideas of crisis, all the stories, the myths, the films we tell, much of the history, is of a martial nature. It's about taking up weapons. It's about brute strength. It's interesting how few of the myths and narratives of Western culture really talk about the kinds of struggle and crisis you can only overcome, not through violence, but through something more like intelligence, but through long, hard slog, but through perhaps complex puzzle solving of something new that's come up that will require you to change your life. There are so many other kinds of war that we can wage rather than the military one. One of the useful things about looking at cultures like China is that they help us to see models of crisis response, of strength and of heroism that are not just about killing stuff, right? So if we look at Chinese philosophy, in many ways, the ideal is taken from, if you look at Taoism, for instance, it's an ideal of balance. Balance with the natural world, balance within society. And balance is something that always has to be negotiated. You always are trying to readjust yourself to the forces that are pushing you this way and that. There's no such thing as pure stillness in some respects. The world is a dynamic, busy, dangerous place. And so it helps us to think about crisis in a different way. You can't just kill the monster, monster's dead, move on. We have models of crisis response that are more about a kind of sensitivity a flexibility and an ongoing learning to dance with difficulty.
Tell me about Gun Yu, and you know, you correct me if I don't get his names right. Who was he and why is he important in this context?
Well, it's interesting to look back through history. What are the great mythological stories that kind of shape our culture? Gun Yu's almost like the King Arthur of the Chinese world, right? You go back to ancient tales of the establishment of China and a kind of mythic, prehistoric, before time of the nation's memory. There's an idea that there were great emperors, and these great emperors kind of, they brought the rule of heaven with them. They thought not in banal worldly terms, but they brought the very grace of a higher thinking with them. A bit like a droit de Dieu, the idea that the divine right is with these leaders. And each emperor is praised for bringing some element of civilization to the huge landmass that was China. You know, many tribes, many landscapes, many dangers and difficulties. One of the emperors, Emperor Yao, his great challenge was to face floods. Floods, you know, we think of this as a problem in England. It can, you know, hurt people mostly. It kind of destroys your property. But floods in China, which is one of the world's largest watersheds, down from the Himalayas out towards the Pacific Ocean, vast amounts of water coming in monsoons every year. Floods are massively life-threatening events. Of course, they're unstoppable and often unpredictable. And so the Emperor Yao has to deal with this major, major experience of flooding. In the story, he looks for a hero who can help him. And it's really interesting to think, what kind of hero are we looking for? Is it going to be, you know, Lancelot with a sword? No, he can't do a thing against a flood. What we need is, an engineer. He's a different kind of hero. And the hero arises. Gun Yu is the son of a floods engineer. He spends more than a decade traveling around the country, understanding the technology of agriculture and water and geology. And he comes up with damming and ways to stem the floods, and even better, turn them into a benefit, which is irrigation. And the Chinese world not only survives, but it flourishes. So Gun Yu is a wonderful story of a different kind of hero, perhaps, than most of the ones we know in the West.
And he's also very much sort of the ideal sort of public servant, in a sense, because he doesn't seek richness or wealth. How would you describe his character?
Yeah, that's a wonderful part of the story. The stories often emphasize the idea that Gun Yu is not the son of the king. Right. So in that sense, King Arthur kind of plays the game. He grows up as a commoner, but he turns out to be the son of the king. But the commoner part is important because he gains everyday practical values. Gun Yu just isn't the son of the king. He really is a commoner. And it's totally the meritocratic value of what he's learned that makes all the difference. And this is highlighted in the stories because he spends years. He doesn't, you know, once he's in power, he doesn't sit around enjoying the trappings of his earnings. He traipses through the floods, through the water, through the cold, all over the country, in the mud, and tries to understand the problem. So he's, as you say, a public servant. He gives himself in service to the public at the everyday level, not just, you know, in those few hours in the office. And Confucius highlights this. Confucius, when he's looking for models to give the people of China in his own writings, he speaks about Gun Yu. He says, there was no flaw to be seen in this man. And that means, partly a very modern thing, there's no corruption. There's no egotism. There's no little bit of extra money he's getting off the side. What he's doing is really giving himself to the public good. And that's a distinctive mark of heroism.
So can he be described as sort of the Vi Junzi, the ideal man? Is that what you're describing? Because that is a key concept within Confucianism, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think there's a really important lesson to be learned from him. And it reminds us of how radically different the ideal of the Confucian leader is from, in many ways, the ideal of the West, or the kind that we see in the mythology anyway. Confucius talks about the man who is not turned by power, who is not excited by fame, who is not swayed, as it were, by these major forces. He's upright. Confucius says a good leader, a good king, is like the North Star. He holds his position. He's clear about virtue, he's clear about his goals, and he holds that position, and the world can turn around him. He doesn't change according to what the polls tell him is kind of trendy or popular to say. So that we see a kind of a model of leadership in the Gun Yu character, And I think it's probably true that we also see a model for the everyday person. Some cultures have a much stronger ethos that you don't try and get the best for yourself. Rather, everyone invests in the public good. On a small scale, I'm always amazed when I go to Berlin and you try to cross the street and the English person, you know, myself, we look, if there's a car coming, we try and dodge out and get out before him and we leave everyone else standing at the corner. But the Berliners stand there and they wait and they respect the traffic rules because they understand in some deeper sense this creates a fabric, a structured order of society that in the end benefits everyone. And that's an extension, it's a version of what we're seeing in this Confucian case. People have pointed out that if the Chinese were happier to wear face masks already, in some ways that's shored up by a sense that there is a large-scale public good that's served by that kind of activity.
I think it's interesting that you're pointing out that we're not talking about here basically slaying the monster. It's still some type of force because it's about taming, isn't it? You're taming nature to take control. You mold the environment so it sort of suits man. Am I right in that?
It's an interesting question in many ways. In the 20th century, when people were trying to understand the rise of China, Chinese communism was a big sort of thing, and Western countries were also thinking about how to form their own governments. There's a Chinese thinker called Ji Chaoding who wrote a book that influenced Western thinkers, and he described China as a world that had developed its concept of power in relation to the issue of water control, right? You've got all these different major river deltas around the world. Civilization often grows up around them. Look at Egypt, look at Mesopotamia and Babylon, look at the Indus civilization in India, etc. Look at Rome. But what's important in many ways for that leadership is to be able to tame not just the people, but the nature. And that has a particular character to it. You can't just use violence. You need massive scale engineering, huge scale planning, serious collaboration and cooperation from large numbers of the workforce. And so there's an idea of a geography that kind of creates a collaborative force, if you like, of civilizational power, and that's something that really shaped the way that China thinks about its own political history, its own political background.
What I find fascinating when we look at this, you have the molding of the environment. This seems to be part of Chinese philosophy, as you've been discussing. But if we broaden our horizon in Asia, there's different approaches. And I'm thinking about the animist culture and how they understand disaster. So first of all, where do we find the animist tradition?
Animist traditions are everywhere. It's in many ways the original and most widespread nature of belief, of religion, I think probably almost anywhere in the world, whether it's North American tribes, whether it's South America, whether it's the Middle East, Africa very much is still animist, and almost all of Asia. China's a special case because, you know, as you imply, the creation of empire in China also meant the establishment of huge-scale ideologies that often pushed away a lot of the local underlying beliefs. But if you go to China on the ground, if you go to most of the areas around it, you still see the animist worldview. And, you know, what is that worldview? Animism really is about saying the world around us is a complex combination of many forces. And those forces are dynamic. They're always in action. They're not always predictable. You know, there are seasons. Yes, we have a summer, a spirit of summer that we can rely on. But the spirit of storm is very unpredictable, as we've seen recently. So they're not always predictable. They are capricious. They're powerful. We rely upon the harvest. We rely upon the land. We rely upon water, rain, etc. And so animist ideas really express the notion that human life is lived within the matrix of many different powerful forces that shape us. People often will speak about these forces as spirits, as gods or demons. And that's right. But it's also important to understand they don't just mean fairies at the bottom of the garden. They mean something like another kind of agency, another kind of force, almost a will. You know, they're not tiny people, but they are something that you can see almost as persons in a larger natural community. And so animism gives us a different way of thinking about how to relate to nature. You're right, it's not so much about getting control over it as often acknowledging and negotiating with those existing forces.
How does it work in sort of modern Asia? How do you combine this with still a modern life?
Well, in some ways, I think that the development of technologies to do with nature often went along with animist ideas. Weather is a good point, and also agriculture. If you go to many parts of the world, go to Bali, for instance, you will see that Bali has an incredibly complex technology of its farming strategy, because all the water comes down from the volcano at the top of the island, and huge amounts of water are needed to feed the rice crops, which are central to that island. The control of water here is also very important. But it's a small area. It's much more predictable. It's right there in the monsoon zone. So people's careful control of the water and their careful cultivation of the arable land on the island is linked to a completely mutually embedded belief in the spirits, the spirit of fertility, an understanding of the things they have to do to cultivate that spirit, to keep it happy, often which involve ways of actually respecting the land.
What does it mean to keep it happy? So what do you actually do? Is it just being nice, or is it actually communicating? Is it giving back?
Yeah, a good question. It differs from different cultures, actually. I mean, so if you contrast, let's say, Bali with Thailand, a country I'm very fond of, Bali has a much more difficult natural environment, much more volatile in terms of the crops, and it believes that the spirits of the island are more difficult and more volatile accordingly. You can see that the spirit world mirrors the natural world. And actually, the Balinese have developed a really complex system of very, very detailed rituals that have to be done constantly by a member of the family. Quite a lot of money is put into it, and they're very specific, and there's a priesthood who tells you whether you got them right. So it becomes an industry of its own. You know, some of it actually feeds directly into controlling and helping and, you know, shaping the relationship with nature. Some of it, I think, is psychological. It also helps people to make sense of the uncertainty of life. That's the Balinese spirits. They're more exacting and a bit more scary in a way. The Thai spirits, and Thailand is a landscape that is easy. That is, it has flooding, but it also is extremely fertile. The Thai word for Thailand is Suvarnabhumi, which means golden earth. It's full of crops. It's full of beautiful fruits. It's full of all kinds of things you can eat. And its spirits are considered to be, similarly, actually quite benevolent. On the whole, not very exacting, relatively easygoing. So I've walked through Thai jungles and you'll see people leaving, I don't know, a pack of cigarettes. If it's a male spirit, I love this. You know, the guy spirit, what's he going to want to do? He's going to want to do what you and your mates do. Yeah. Have a cigarette, you know. Female spirits, even female spirits who've died in childbirth. This is a common Thai idea of another natural crisis you cannot avoid. They become ghosts often. But actually, if you give them gifts and make friends with them, they help to guard and to guide and comfort women and their children. So they turn into very positive spirits. What do you give them? Well, a lot of them like lipstick. They like pretty things to go in their hair. They're quite girly a lot of the time. It's just interesting to see that the spirit world, its own character, really mirrors the natural world and its own character. It's almost an expression of how you can relate to nature as a constant ongoing dialogue.
If we take an example, a tsunami, for example, which is, of course, was a massive disaster. How was that disaster treated within the animist tradition afterwards?
Yeah, it was a huge event. And of course, quite apart from the trauma, which was enormous for the peoples of, for instance, the Thai Andaman coast or the north of Sumatra, but quite apart from that, if you see the sea as a massive spirit who, for a lot of those peoples, governed every part of their life, a lot of people of the Andaman Ocean are sea gypsies, which means they swim, they live, they completely live upon and in the sea. If you see it in terms of the sea goddess's act, it was terrifying. It's like the flood in the Bible. It's like a god or a god, the god who shapes most of your life, who you have the deepest relationship with, acts suddenly out of the blue and destroys everything, kills, you know, vast swathes of your family. And so it was I think it was really a traumatic experience. And if you go to those regions, you see the memorials everywhere. You can see the complex attempt to make sense of that crisis. But it's also interesting that if you go to the traditional cultures of that region, so for instance, the Chaule of the Andaman area, their shamans had clear plans in action. And the shamans said, oh, here's what we have to do. We have to now make more offerings to the sea goddess. Let's let her know that we respect her. Let's make sure we're not doing anything bad to the sea. So there were concerns with pollution of the seawater, with overfishing, with overdevelopment. A lot of those coasts are tourist areas and the sea is becoming more distant from the people and more full of bad things. And so there was a rethinking. And some of those areas really changed their environmental policy and local practice as a result to try and keep the sea goddess a bit happier. Interesting that in some areas that were affected by the tsunami, there are groups who knew that the tsunami was coming because past mythology had passed down the idea that if the sea recedes, don't go down to the beach, run to the high ground. And people knew that this was part of the mythology of the goddesses and the spirits. And because they went to the high ground, these were people who survived. So the whole ancient tradition of relationship with the beings who are part of the crisis, as it were, seen in terms of their natural agency, it kind of helped people to rethink what they needed to do to improve their relationship.
But how is political leadership conceptualized within the animist framework? Because how does it really play out in real life? I mean, if we talk about the taming of nature, that is something that comes more naturally with political leadership rather than negotiating with the spirits.
It's a good question. And in a way, I think it's an issue that many animist cultures have kind of tried to find their footing on. You're right. On the one hand, if the spirits are already there, if you're relating to the spirits, what are your leaders there to do exactly? One answer is that the leader here is not so much a tamer of nature or a fighter of enemies. They're a kind of shaman, i.e. their main goal is indeed to negotiate with, relate to, and kind of organize your relationship with the natural world. And in some ways, that's a really good way to think of it. Indeed, if you take an example of the previous Thai king, King Bhumibol of Thailand, who sadly is now gone, he was, all leaders are controversial figures, but one of the things for which he was revered by many of his people was that he was constantly seen in the fields of the country, seen in the fisheries of the country, seen in at the dams and in the places where nature was being actively dealt with. Indeed, if you went to the movies in Thailand, you'd see a film and a lot of the images were of him, not in military uniform, but primarily with farmers and engineers, literally reaching down and touching the land. So I think there's an element there of an idea, there's something of the Gunyu model. You're supposed to understand the world in order to negotiate with it, but also to, in a sense, respect it and maintain a relationship that's rooted in genuine interaction with the landscape. It used to be that our leaders might themselves have been farmers once or might themselves have been actively in industry. And that's very rarely the case these days. We tend to see the path to leadership as something that comes out of a much more clerical kind of journey. But it's interesting that in a lot of animist countries, there's a sense that your leader should still be someone who can be a shaman. And just briefly on the negative side of that, of course, one of the dangers of a shamanic model of leadership, or indeed of an animist model, can a person themselves be a spirit or a god? And you do get cases where leaders will kind of posture, in a sense, will position themselves as a kind of spirit, a being who has direct access to higher powers. And that can have its dangers. That's often when we get, if you like, a kind of religious or supernatural authority grabbed, grasped, and then used for their own purposes by corrupt leadership.
Looking at the models we've now been discussing, so we have taming and then we have sort of negotiating with nature. India, of course, is a very interesting case because it seems to be at least two different models of approaching crisis within the culture. First, what happened in Kerala in May in 2018?
Well, India, with its long history of pandemic and illness, had a new virus come to its land. And this was the Nipah virus, which was extremely dangerous, very high death rates, does much greater damage than most of the viruses that pass through the population. And it arrives in a place in Kerala, and Kerala is, like all of India, fairly populous. It also has large migrant populations who come in and out of the state, so migrate back and forth to other areas of India. And so it's very hard to control. And it's an extremely educated state, but a very poor state as well. In many cases, sanitation, healthcare is not that fabulous. So what do you do? It could have been an enormous, dangerous situation with many, many deaths. But a hero arose from the ranks of the Kerala government. And that hero was a female minister called KK Shailaja. And she immediately put into action her knowledge, her wisdom. Fortunately, she happened to have a Bachelor of Science, and she had been a teacher, a science teacher herself. She had a good sense of what it means to deal with the problem, not just politically, not just bureaucratically, but scientifically. And I think Kerala has still quite a strong village structure. It sees itself as a kind of a large community, as a very distinctive communal kind of character. And she also wanted to make sure she could communicate with the people and make them feel that they're with her, that the community is strong, and to make her reasoning transparent. So she immediately went into action, very, very quickly mobilized the whole community and did things like made sure that people knew to declare themselves if they were ill, to quarantine, to not be scared or ashamed or worried. Everyone understood the situation. To make quarantine spaces, to let villagers not be scared or oust or throw out those people, but rather nurture them in their situation. And to continue a kind of a test and trace model. And through all of this, and again, throughout bringing in the community on her side to understand why it was important, not hiding, not being afraid, through all of this, she was able to almost completely nullify the threat of the Nipah virus, a model that made her famous. It even inspired an Indian film called Virus, in which she was played by a popular movie star as a hero. And of course, it was a great template for when coronavirus arrived.
And she's now been, am I right, she's been called the Corona Slayer?
Yes.
Is that
yes.
How should we understand her within the sort of Hindu tradition? You've been in your essay for Engelsberg Ideas, you're talking about Dharma Queens. What is that?
Yeah, she is, I mean, in some ways she was set up as the great warrior queen, right? She fought the virus. And indeed, in some parts of India, people have talked about coronavirus as a demon. Corona, Corona Asura. Asura is a word for a demon or a spirit. And she, like Rama in the Ramayana, the basis of the Diwali holiday, she fought the demon. And like Rama, she was victorious and slayed the demon. So there's a kind of an excited sense that she's this great hero. Interesting as well, though, that one of her other nicknames was not just Coronavirus Slayer, which I think is particularly great, but also Shailaja Teacher. And that reminds you that she was successful because she was a teacher, because she's intelligent, because she brought knowledge, because people respected that knowledge, and because she taught people as she went along with it. So you're not just giving people rules and expecting them to follow them. She's explaining, she was teaching, she made everybody responsible for what had to happen. And in that sense, she's not just the victorious king or queen monarch, she's a dharmic king or queen or monarch. Dharma in India.
And what does it actually mean?
So what dharma means is an Indian concept that signals the right and proper order of things, right? How it ought to be. It's kind of like natural, ethical goodness. So of the kind that when things are as they ought to be, when things are dharmic, things can flourish, right? If things are dharmic, it means your kids are happy, they're nurtured, they're getting well taught, they've got friends, and their personality can really blossom. And so that's a model that can be applied to anything. It can be a person is dharmic, a society is dharmic, all kinds of things. But to be a dharmic leader means that you're leading in such a way that you've got a good sense of how the nation should be, what really works, what is virtuous as well as prosperous and how to make that happen. So in a way, you know, you're kind of channeling the proper order of things and helping to make that real on the worldly plane. Shailaja is a dharmic leader like Rama of the Ramayana or the Kings of the Mahabharata epic. She helps not just fix the problem, but create a good and virtuous order.
I see here sort of the very sort of active concept, a virtuous warrior, I suppose, then. But you also have, which you write about, which I find interesting, the kind of yogic approach, which is, I suppose, the opposite. It's shutting down. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, it's interesting that all the models we've looked at so far are essentially about the idea that a crisis comes along, it causes a problem, you need to get back to normal, someone fixes it, either through massive collaboration that's sort of determined by engineering expertise, that's the Chinese case we looked at, or through a careful sensitivity to nature, constantly renegotiated and respected, that's the animist model. Or maybe through a powerful leader who helps to mobilize and, again, kind of bring the perfect order of things into action in the world. That's the dharmic character. But all of those assume that what you need to do is get back to normal. Some crises, arguably, happen because normal wasn't working, right? Because we need a new normal. And I think there is a set of ideals and heroes, if you like, of crisis, who were about, rather than taking us back to where we were before, they're about taking us through the crisis, helping us survive, but also letting us see what needed to change and make that change. It's more like seeing crisis as a doorway or a portal through which the things which normally we would never even get our heads around, now we can see them in a new light and we can change things if we need to. It's an opportunity and not just a threat. In many ways, this comes out of the yogic philosophy of India. Yoga in its ancient philosophical origins isn't about fitness. It wasn't even about physical postures. It was really about meditation. And it was about taking away the normal patterns of our thinking and allowing you to break them down, to stop all the momentum that keeps you doing the same stuff day by day. If you can stop your own patterns and habits, you potentially have the opportunity to escape from them and to rebuild a new and better version of yourself, according to what discriminating judgment you have about who you'd rather be. Now, if you put that onto a social scale, take it away from just the individual, but to the society, then you see a yogic model of the idea that societies also need to stop sometimes, they need to pause, they need to be able to reassess who they were, get out of their bad habits, and rebuild a new identity and a new way of life. So you do get cases where heroes come along who try and encourage people to embrace crisis and point the way forward.
Do you think that this global lockdown was a sort of a massive yogic experiment?
That's an interesting question. I think that I would like it to be. It certainly was one of the most extraordinary events we've seen globally in the whole of history. And that's really significant. You know, yogic heroes include people like Gandhi. They include all the Buddhist monk political revolutions, even people like Martin Luther King and all those who've tried to use sort of mini lockdown of society or a street or a place as a way to get people to rethink. In theory, it's supposed to be a nonviolent way to force reflection, whether or not it always works that way. The global lockdown, you know, it had the potential, I think, and it may come again, of course, the potential to give people time to think, to get out of old habits, and to help people to rebuild anew in the kind of space that's opened up by maybe not having to go to work every single day in quite the same way, or not spending the same amount of money on delicious cocktails. Whether it gets used in that way is up to us, however. It was interesting and some ways sad to me that early on in the lockdown, there was a lot of talk about how people are changing their patterns, how people don't need to do certain things they used to, but they're really enjoying things like taking a walk or gardening or reading a book. I feel like that discourse is maybe a little bit dispersed once the pubs opened in England, certainly. Everyone's values changed, and suddenly getting back to a pint was a huge thing. And I'm a great fan of a good glass of wine, but maybe there is also an opportunity lost, and it's worth thinking about those points where to stop and to let a little bit of the world fall apart is to make space to build something new.
What would you consider to be the main lessons that we sort of in the Western world can draw from the four traditions we have discussed?
I think that we, first of all, just to remember that you don't always have to follow the narrative of how this is going to get fixed. There are different ways to fix a problem. And so having people think a little bit larger is probably a good thing. I think that the Chinese model wants us to remember that our leaders are supposed to be Gunyu. Our leaders are supposed to be hard-won, very well-informed engineers who know what to do. And they put it, if they don't yet know, they put in the time. And the public are going to have to wait and allow for a certain amount of good analysis to happen if they want a good solution. So the kind of quick fix answer isn't always the best one. And the Shailaja model of the coronavirus slaying Dharma Queen is a similar thing. You know, we're going to need informed responses. I think the animus model reminds us that we need to be aware that nature is not always just going to sit down and play good. Nature is volatile. More viruses probably will happen. We're going to need to rethink our own way of interacting with the larger environment in order for us to be able to make sense of all of these things. I think that's a massive challenge and one that takes a greater sensitivity to the natural world. From the Indian case, from the yogic case, I think I would want to say, if this is a massive global action, event, and change, let's not fear it so much as use it. Let's look at what it teaches us about what we could do with changing in our lives and in our societies, and use it as a way to disrupt the old habits and allow something new to come, so that we can have a more positive and constructive approach to crisis if we have a better handle on what the problems are and what the possibilities might be.
Jessica Frazier, thank you very much.
History Lessons is a podcast from the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.